and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly, the show that provides a heavyweight alternative to the common or garden TV talent show. We'll be swapping singing twins for tech and discarding our dancing shoes for thinking caps as we delve deep into the week's top stories. Today, we hear from one of the founders of SoundCloud, the music distribution platform of choice for the likes of Dave Grohl and Beck, and the occupier of the number two spot in the Tech Media Invest Top 100 list. We also have our first induction into Jack's Hall of Fame, which over the coming months will celebrate the great and the good in the world of technology. Have a listen to this and see if you can guess our first inductee.
The very first computers seemed as big as houses and so mysterious that for most of us, the computer was behind a closed door. But IBM was thinking how to make the computer more useful. And as one good idea led to another, it began getting smaller, faster, less expensive, and easier to use.
Can you tell what it is? Don't worry if that wasn't enough of a clue, as Jack will be ensuring all becomes clear later in the show. My name's Susie Weezer, and joining me this week is a man who fits beautifully into the Simon Cowell role in Tech Weekly, Charles Arthur. Hello, Charles.
I think we should let the public decide.
And joining us today, the man who left to fill the shoes of either Danny Minogue, Cheryl Cole or Louis Walsh, it's Bobby Johnson. Hi, Bobby.
Which one of those is best or worst? I can't work out.
Who would you like to be?
I'm drawing a blank on this one.
Fair enough. Now, Charles, if you had to appear in one of these soul-destroying talent shows, which of your talents would win over the hearts of the nation?
I think it had to be my promise not to sing if they would vote for me.
Bobby, what's your hidden talent?
I have the astonishing ability to sleep on demand, although I admit that wouldn't really be that great for a TV talent show. It'd be quite boring telly, wouldn't it?
It's not exactly a crowd pleaser, I don't think. But there'll be no going to the public vote in this show. All decisions are final. So we better take to the stage and get this extravaganza underway. SoundCloud was launched just last year and has already become the leading online platform for those in the music industry to upload, share and collaborate on audio. It's been described as a kind of email application for music, complete with a play button. Created by Alexander Young and Eric Wolforce, they've recently recruited a former vice president of strategy for MySpace to sit on the board, confirming their position as a serious player.
We've created a Kickass Music inbox where you can scan through all your new incoming tracks before downloading a thing. Check out live updates from people you work with, see what incoming tracks people are talking about, or just play the whole thing like one big personal playlist.
Charles, you spoke to Alexander Young about his plans for the company, but before we hear from him, perhaps you could explain to us what exactly SoundCloud does.
Perhaps the best way to think about it is as a Flickr for music. Flickr, the photo sharing site where people upload stuff. It's public, or you can make it private, and it can be shared with people. You can tag stuff by one form or other. And SoundCloud does the same sort of ideas for bits of music, bits of audio. So, for example, podcasts. It's been very popular with podcasts. And it provides a way for people to basically sample any sort of music that's out there, even to do collaborative work. Though I asked Alexander if that didn't mean that there were going to be big problems as the storage demands grew.
The costs have gone up quite a bit. We're a fairly professional service, so we allow people to upload uncompressed audio as well in very high quality. Yeah, storage does get quite big. We're always looking at new ways of building huge storage clusters. We have a fairly advanced architecture already with different parts of the technology spread out over different parts of the world. It's a lot of storage, but that's fun as well. I mean, it's really fun building huge systems. So, and I think the whole experience of using SoundCloud is very, very easy. And it's a key point of like getting it to the point where an artist doesn't have to worry about the technology. They don't have to worry about file sizes. They don't have to worry about formats or anything like that. So we deal with all of that in the background. And, if we need big service to take care of that, then that's what we get.
Where's your commercial model? Do people get charged to upload a file? Do they get charged to store a file, charged to download a file?
Yeah, I mean, we have free accounts that anybody can use. They don't cost anything. And then when you need more, then you upgrade to a premium account. And there's a couple of different levels. Where
What's the difference?
The free one is quite liberal. It does quite a lot. But if you want, say, you know, more advanced statistics on what's happening with your music, some specific extra sharing features, also more tracks and things like that, if you have a bigger catalog you need to store, then you can opt in for a premium account.
So is there anything to stop someone just saying, oh, I think I'll use SoundCloud to make a backup of my music library?
Well, technically you could do it, but if you're, say, a music collector with, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of audio, then there will probably be better solutions than SoundCloud for storing all of that online.
And what about the sort of discovery aspect? I mean, one of the things that works on Flickr is that you can find photos, you know, you get the sets of photos, the collections, yeah, the tagging and so on. How does that work with music? Is that part of your idea there, that people should be able to find similar tracks or similar artists,
right,
or things like that?
We're always thinking a lot about it, but at the moment we're not actually creating that many tools for discovery. There's a lot of really good music, consumer music sites out there that focus a lot on discovery and music recommendations and things like that. And I think, you know, that's a really, really interesting space, but there's quite a lot of cool things being built there already. Whereas, like, just the basics of allowing people to share things they already have, that's where it's really something missing at the moment. So we're going to be looking more at that in the future, especially with our APIs. So we have open APIs, which just means that anybody can actually program another website or another application using parts of the SoundCloud platform, just like Flickr has. And with Flickr, the APIs became a really big part of music discovery because it allows somebody else to build a completely different kind of website that brings out certain types of content. For instance, on Flickr, you could build a separate photo site that focuses on images from San Francisco taken with a Nikon camera with a certain focal depth on the lens, if you want. We're also doing something a little bit similar to that. There's, for instance, a site called citysounds.fm, which pulls in different tracks from SoundCloud from specific cities and also pulls in images from Flickr from that city and showcases it in a really nice UI. So you could get music from LA and the pictures from LA. On the site itself, it's not so much about discovering music, but more about being able to work with the music you've already made.
Do you see people sort of passing tracks around, trying to enhance things? Is there a way to sort of re-record or layer? Or
yeah, there's a lot of collaboration going on because a big part of how people use it is with private sharing. So private sharing of tracks while they're in production. So it might be, you know, I'm a hip-hop producer. I've done some beats. I send them over to a different producer who's working with another rapper who layers some stuff on top of it and then sends it back. And there's a really cool aspect of that is that you can graphically also you can put comments inside of the track at specific time points. So if you're collaborating on something, you can actually go in and say, the drums right here are good, or the bass line here is really bad, which is really quite a cool thing in collaboration. You can see there's some like private sharing cases where people are getting into these long discussion threads about a specific hi-hat sound or something like that, which is quite cool.
And just on the, I mean, I know that you're not doing tagging the way that Flickr does tagging, but mm-hmm. is the idea of tagging music, is it feasible, do you think? I mean, you can do things like, you know, what the beats per minute is, or you could do a rough genre, but it's always been rather elusive, hasn't it?
Right. Well, I think there is some really interesting things that can be done. You can get quite far with basic tagging, sort of, I mean, like the regular user-generated tags on Flickr. I mean, we have similar things as well, but I think, I mean, with Flickr as well, you can get really interesting when you start having machine-generated tags as well, like, for instance, the info from the camera in that case. There could be some quite cool things around that with music as well. We for instance, have a lot of cool integrations coming up with music software manufacturers. So you'll actually be able to save stuff to the web directly from within the program where you're making the music. And that opens up kind of some new possibilities for tagging as well, which we haven't explored fully yet, but
But you're not quite going to the sort of level of saying, you know, Zildjian cymbals and pearl drums and that sort of thing.
Oh, who knows? I mean, if RFID stuff gets more into physical goods as well, that could happen.
That was Charles there talking to Alexander Young, one of the founders of SoundCloud. Charles, their business model is to charge for premium features, and it's a very popular model, but one that lots of companies have found sometimes difficult to make profitable. Do you think that SoundCloud might run into this problem?
I think that actually they've got a good chance of making it work because a lot of record companies are interested by it. A lot of artists are interested by it. And the fact that you can collaborate, you know, from pretty much anywhere you can get the internet means that it's popular with people who are trying to work all over, all around the world. If it's difficult to get a couple of artists together, you can still do it in this model. So I think actually that they've got a chance of making this really run. And given the fact the storage costs halve every year, roughly, they do have the potential to make it work. The problem with companies that offer the freemium model, you know, where you offer some services for free and then you have paid for services at the top end, is always the one that it's sort of more tempting as the sort of the basic level gets cheaper for you to provide, for you just to offer more and more stuff for free, so that the people who used to pay for something get a bit annoyed because they feel that what they used to have to pay for, the people who are just coming along now getting free. That's the reason they do this is because they're trying to appeal to a broader user base. But I think if they can keep wraps on it and if they can really keep in control of it, then actually they could make a really profitable service.
Okay, so at its current format, it's very much aimed at the music industry. So it's professional musicians, company executives. Is the average music fan ever going to come in contact with it? Are they going to use it?
Well, Tim Jones of The Guardian used it at Glastonbury, actually. He was recording short pieces with people he met in the field and uploading them to SoundCloud, and it was sort of instant podcast. So, yeah, you know, the average person can use it. Unsigned artists could certainly use it because record labels are looking around on there for interesting new music.
So one to watch then, definitely.
Definitely.
Okay. If you think SoundCloud are the only company creating a storm in the world of technology, you'd be very much mistaken. Here's Bobby with a roundup of the latest headlines.
The games industry saw the release of Modern Warfare 2 this week, the latest in the Call of Duty series that pundits suggest will be this year's biggest blockbuster. In fact, the game is expected to be so popular that many rival publishers are holding back their big releases until after Christmas. A drawn-out legal battle between the owners of Skype and the people who founded it finally came to a close last week with a settlement that sees Niklas Zennström and Jannes Friis regain a 14% share in the company. The duo had sued over eBay's proposal to sell Skype to a group of investors, a deal which will now go through with some changes. More good news for technology entrepreneurs after Google announced that it was paying $750 million for mobile advertising company AdMob, while London startup Playfish, which makes games for social networks like Facebook, was bought by Electronic Arts for as much as $400 million. And a survey of internet users suggests that 19% of us now use sites like Facebook and Twitter to share information about ourselves online. At the same time, the average age of users continues to rise, with a typical Facebooker now standing at 33 years old. That's up from 26 just 18 months ago.
So we heard there the average age of Facebook users has increased 6 years in 18 months. Bobby, do you think there's any particular reason for that?
Well, aside from the fact that we're obviously all aging at internet speed now, that might be something to do with it. We're all getting older that fast. I think it's just generally the network effect of Facebook. If early adopters were younger people, you know, maybe the 18 to 30-year-olds, now
they had to be. They had to be, didn't they? Because it was all they were all the college people.
Because it was all based around college networks, exactly. And so, you know, that base was there already. If you're going to add more users to that, they either have to be in other countries, which is also happening, or they have to be older users, and that's what's happening. I think this is a kind of natural evolution. Whether people like it or not, whether it changes the nature of Facebook when your grandparents are on it. I don't know.
Fair enough. Yeah, good point. Ooh, scary thought. And Twitter sign-ups are still on the rise as well, but 90% of tweets come from 10% of its users. Is this Twitter being weird, or is this a kind of imbalance generally accepted in social networking?
I think it's actually fairly typical. There are, in any kind of user-generated area, I hate that phrase, but in any kind of user-generated area online, there tends to be a rule of return in which a small group of people are very active. Most people are just passive consumers. So I don't think that's... In fact, I mean, there's an argument that 10% of people creating 90% of the content isn't that bad, actually, for Twitter. And it all depends on who you follow anyway. So it depends how noisy you want your stream to be.
Okay, what about this Skype story? Charles, two of the original founders are kind of back in the driving seat now. Do you think we'll see changes at the company?
I don't think that we'll see changes as such, but I think that we'll see them pushing Skype much more heftily now that eBay is basically getting shot of it. I think they'll again try to turn it into what I think they always really wanted it to be, which was the big internet success story. And it really is one of the internet success stories. It's just that it, by being taken over by eBay, it sort of subsided. People thought eBay was going to do something amazing and magical with it. And it turned out that eBay didn't have the clearest idea at all, really, of what they did want to do. So I think we're going to see Skype being pushed much more for internet telephony, much more as a replacement for landline and international phones, and being pushed out onto mobiles.
I think it's interesting. We've just heard that they've hired a senior executive from Cisco, which was obviously a deal that was in the works, but I assume probably reliant on the settlement being reached. I would really imagine that they're going to push this very hard as a business tool, as well as the kind of consumer tool that we're all used to. So the interesting thing is, what happens to Skype further down the line? Do they go for another acquisition in a few years' time when it's worth, you know, several times more, perhaps? Or do they try and beat somebody like Cisco at their own game in the long term?
Well, if that wasn't enough for you, you can find out more about all of those stories and the latest tech headlines on the Guardian Tech homepage. Just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Time for a new feature now, in the form of Jack's Hall of Fame. Over the next few months, our own Jack Schofield will be inducting those that have changed the face of the industry into what can only be described as a Madame Tussauds for nerds. This being the first week, the hall is looking a little sparsely populated, but as time goes on, it'll become jam-packed in a celebration of the top ideas, products and people in tech. So, without further ado, let's cut the red ribbon and take a look inside.
Here we are in the entirely empty Tech Weekly Hall of Fame, and the first product that inevitably we're going to introduce is the IBM PC. This was introduced in August 1981 by IBM, which was by far the biggest and most powerful computer company of the day, and it really transformed the whole computer landscape. If you looked at it, it seemed a rather dull machine. It was a standard three-box system, but it was a beautifully put-together industrial product. I had an Apple II on my desk at the time, and getting an IBM PC was a transformation in terms of the actual way it was put together. The keyboard was beautiful. The screen, high-resolution phosphor, was so much more legible. It was a completely different world.
IBM made its personal computer to help a person be more productive, to help a person be more creative. And those are good reasons for a person to feel good. The IBM personal computer.
The previous kind of computers that people like me had used were designed by and for enthusiasts. They were, at very best, small business machines. But the IBM PC was there to be adopted by large companies to make microcomputing acceptable in a corporate context, which it hadn't been before. And that was a big breakthrough, and that's one of the things that the IBM PC did really well.
Oh, I see your desk got a computer on it.
Yeah, smart desk. Going to the game?
Me, I don't need a computer.
I'll see you at the game.
Yeah, actually, I've got a little more to do.
Some people don't need an IBM computer on their desk.
The IBM PC was a bit of an odd development for IBM. It was led by a man called Don Estridge. Normally, IBM would have used its own technologies. and would have owned and controlled its own proprietary technologies. It wanted to get into the PC market in a hurry because Apple had been successful with the Apple II. And so it went to outside firms. It went to Microsoft for BASIC originally, and then for the operating system. It went to Intel for the processor. Further than that, the IBM PC was also designed to be compatible with the growing microcomputer industry. And so it used industry standard parts, Shugart disk drives and so on. And that meant that other companies could join in both as IBM part suppliers and by building their own systems, which became PC clones.
Now is a good time to look at IBM, the complete answer. An IBM PC can run the latest, most powerful programs and give you almost unlimited expandability with options like the new IBM printers and the IBM PC network.
When it was released, the IBM PC was a reasonable system with an Intel 8088 microprocessor, a whole 64K of memory, and a 160K floppy drive cost $2,880, which sounds rather a lot, but was kind of reasonable at the time. The first one I had was an IBM PC XT, and that was the model that introduced a massive 10 megabyte hard drive. The adoption of Intel and Microsoft of these outside technologies enabled thousands of other companies to set up manufacturing IBM PC clones, and people started to write directly to the IBM hardware. And so it turned out that it wasn't just acceptable to have an MS-DOS machine, it had to be IBM PC compatible. And that set a hardware standard that became tremendously important. IBM did in fact try to move the industry back to IBM-owned technologies. We had the Gang of Eight led by Compaq to fight IBM, and in fact the Gang of Eight prevailed. IBM lost control of the standard, which passed to mainly Intel and Microsoft. IBM went back to making PCs, and that made Intel and Microsoft the powers that they are today.
So Jack kicked things off there with the IBM PC, thanks to the legacy it left for the likes of Intel and Microsoft. But Charles, who's revolutionising PCs nowadays, would you say?
PCs, that's a difficult one, actually. I mean, it's not so much the PC itself, it's more all the things that are being done on the web and all the implementations of web applications and even the things that are being done on mobiles. That's where the really interesting stuff is happening. I'd particularly point to mobiles and augmented reality apps that pull in GPS and wireless data and stuff like that. That's where really interesting things are happening right now.
Bobby, what about you? Do you have any alternative entries you'd like to nominate?
Well, I think spinning off that, I agree with Charles. You know, the mobile phone industry is the PC industry of today. But you know, let's give credit to companies like Asus who are trying to do new stuff in the PC industry right now. Probably without the EPC, we wouldn't have seen the explosion of the netbook market, which, you know, in the long term may actually ring the death knell for PCs, because they don't make anyone much money. But still, for consumers, they're obviously something that people really want. So that I think that's where the excitement is now in PC hardware. Apart from just the sheer power that you can get out of machines now. I mean, you know, Jack was talking about spending half his annual salary there on a computer that was millions of times less powerful than what you and I carry around in our pockets today. I think that in itself is incredible.
So there you go, have it. That's our expert nominations. But this Hall of Fame is a democratic movement, and it's not just up to us. We want your suggestions as to who you think should be included. It could be a person such as Bill Gates or Alan Turing, a place like Bletchley Park or Cupertino, or a product along the lines of the BlackBerry or the iPod. But obviously we've thought of all those, so hit us up on Twitter or Facebook with your far superior and way more original suggestions. And now we come to the time which never fails to leave me gawping in amazement, as we hear your reactions to the stories of the week via the comments section of the blogs. Charles, what's been going on the tech blog?
Well, I wrote about Apple's time capsule, which has had what looks like a raised number of failures after 18 months or so. It's a wireless device which holds a hard drive in it, which is meant to back up your data. And the trouble is that for lots of people, they find that their backup has died at some stage. This led to a very long comment thread where there's a commenter who said, well, yeah, but the backups haven't been lost, have they? It's a backup. The backup also had failed, so you have the original. If the backup that caused the primary drive also failed, that would make sense. So basically what they're saying is, hey, don't worry, the backup might be dead, but you've still got the original. To which Thomas333 said, Christ on a bike, I cannot believe people are actually arguing in apparent seriousness that it's not a major issue if the backup fails because you still have the original as a backup for the backup. The whole point of this kind of technology is it's meant to protect you from sudden unexpected failure of the original. When the backup dies, your original is vulnerable until you back it up again. What happens if your main hard drive buys it while you're sorting out a new time capsule? You might as well have not bothered backing up at all if the backup can't be relied on. FFS. If this really is a significant trend, the time capsule is critically flawed and ought to be recalled.
I have to say, I kind of agree. It would make me completely freak out if my backup failed. Now, the launch of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 has been the hot topic over on the games blog, with Matt123 raising questions over the alleged superior AI. He wrote, not so sure that the AI is that superior, especially at one point where I was crouched at the top of a staircase and no less than 6 enemies came up the stairs, one at a time, allowing me to shoot them in the face. Surely, if the AI was that clever, the 6th guy would have thought, 5 of my mates have just walked up those stairs and died. Maybe I shouldn't go up there. Oh well, what's the worst that can happen? Bang! Personally, Matt, I think that makes Modern Warfare remarkably similar to my favourite game ever, Lemmings.
Yeah, but then again, maybe it was the 7th one sort of thought, no, I'm going to run away.
Genius. They've thought of that. Bobby, what's been going on the digital content blog?
Interestingly, Mercedes has written a few things about Google this week, including a piece on the future of Google News and Eric Schmidt's thoughts there, which kind of plays off interestingly against what Rupert Murdoch's been saying this week and how he hates Google and all of this stuff. But I thought I'd keep it pretty short and sweet with a comment from Fabius Maximus, who said, considering the future of all these things, why not just give us implants? It would save all the wiring.
Sweet. On Twitter, we've been admonished by Chris Ivans for not updating Twitter enough. And quite right too. Consider our hands slapped and our feed more active. And don't forget, we're asking for your most complicated home electronic setup. Show us your rat's nest of wires, your NASA challenging monitor setup, or your audiophile dream come true. Upload your photos to Flickr and then add them to the Guardian Tech Weekly photo group. We'll be highlighting some of the best in future shows. Now, as well as Flickr, you can speak to us via the medium of Facebook and Twitter. You can find the links to all of these on guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
In Thursday's Guardian Tech section, more on the state of web security. Servers are increasingly being targeted for hacking, but how are they found? Through Google and with a list of vulnerabilities. The anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is back in the news with the leak of details about high-level discussions on how to stop worldwide illicit copying. We tell you what you should know. Free Our Data looks at how the US courts try to charge for court documents online, until someone wrote a Firefox extension that redistributes the documents for free. And we test a camcorder that's splash resistant, look at protection rackets in The Sims, and Cory Doctorow tries to work out what's going through Rupert Murdoch's mind. It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
And that brings us to the end of the show. The last order of business is for me to thank this week's guest, Alexander Young from SoundCloud and The Guardian's Jack Schofield, as well as my studio mates, Charles Arthur and Bobby Johnson. Before we go, Bobby, do you have any ridiculous tech setup you'd like to come clean about?
Well, I think the audio setup on which I record this this very show in the wardrobe in my spare room would come close. It's I've got a new setup since the last time I put a photo up, so I should probably let you know what's going on there. But it's a very rickety, bizarre collection of egg boxes and random. There's some bicycle helmets here. How about that?
We want to see it, please. Charles, does the number of monitors on your desk run into double figures?
Well, if you're counting in binary, yeah.
Geekiest answer ever. Next week, there'll be a whole new host of tech loveliness for us to dissect and discuss. But until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.